I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin met privately yesterday after delivering speeches at the United Nations General Assembly. And if pictures are to be believed, it looked like a frosty conversation. Both leaders talked about the crisis in Syria and its president, Bashar al-Assad. Putin supports Assad, believing he is the one who can defeat ISIS and the spread of terrorism in the region. Obama says Assad, whom he called a tyrant, must go to bring political stability to Syria. Here's what Obama told the UN on Monday.
Nowhere is our commitment to international order more tested than in Syria. When a dictator slaughters tens of thousands of his own people, that is not just a matter of one nation's internal affairs. It breeds human suffering on an order of magnitude that affects us all. Likewise, when a terrorist group beheads captives, slaughters the innocent, and enslaves women, it's not a single nation's national security problem. That is an assault on all our humanity.
We'll be talking about U.S. relations with Russia and later U.S. relations with China. Joining us now is David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor for Foreign Policy, author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And David Rothkopf, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Angela Stent. She's senior fellow at the Transatlantic Academy. She's on leave from Georgetown University, author of a book called The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela Stent, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And I do want to talk about Syria, but first let me just talk about the relationship between Putin and Obama and the fact that they met yesterday. To you, Angela Stanton, you're someone who was interviewed Vladimir Putin. Is it good that these two world leaders sat down and had a private conversation?
Yes, I think it was very important because they hadn't had a face-to-face conversation like that at any length for 2 years. And however difficult the relationship, and just look at the body language, and you can probably glean from that how they feel about each other. You know, Russia has made it clear, in case we forgot, that you cannot solve a problem like Syria or some of the upheavals in the Middle East without talking to Russia, and that Russia can also act as a spoiler. So however difficult the conversation was, and I noted with amusement that Mr. Putin used words like frank and businesslike to discuss the meeting, which was, you know, in the Soviet period when they used words like that, that meant it was a pretty tough meeting. You know, at least they heard each other out. They talked about Syria and Ukraine. It may not lead to very much, but it was important to do it.
David, someone described the relationship between these two world leaders as having a personal Cold War. I guess the question is whether the Cold War is over or not. Is it important that these two leaders that don't see eye to eye on many issues, that they at least sit down and talk to each other?
It's important that they sit down and talk to each other precisely because they don't see eye to eye. They do have a frosty relationship. It is extremely unlikely that at any time in the remaining 16 months of the Obama presidency, that relationship is going to improve. But on a whole host of issues, from the issues of Eastern Europe surrounding Ukraine, now on to Syria and Iraq, which are not just local issues anymore, obviously, with Syrian refugees streaming into Europe, it's very, very clear that the Russians are not only involved and potentially a spoiler, but are actually now taking the initiative, are now starting to dictate some of the terms of what's going to happen there, and that if the U.S. wants a seat at the table, they're going to have to have it alongside the Russians.
Do you think there's danger in that, David, knowing, of course, there are no easy answers to what's going on in Syria or the Middle East, that the further Russia gets involved, it could become their Afghanistan, for instance?
Well, I think Afghanistan was their Afghanistan. I think there's a possibility that they could have problems in achieving their goals there. But I think we have to be careful in assessing just what those goals are. If their goal is to stabilize Syria, impose the rule of Damascus back over the whole country, and begin a kind of a healing process, that seems really unlikely. If their goal is smaller, which is to stabilize Assad long enough that they can either participate in a negotiation in which he departs and they get to help pick who succeeds him, or they can just simply keep him in power, you know, that may be achievable. They won't get the whole country, and there's going to be an ongoing problem with refugees. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that refugees streaming into Europe, which strengthen the European right, actually weaken the EU, and that plays to Mr. Putin's long-term agenda of having the EU as less of a threat.
To you, Angela, help us understand why Russia supports Assad and the regime of Assad, and certainly supported him early on when there was a civil war and protesters took to the streets. What's in it for Russia?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that the most important determinant of Russian foreign policy, as in any country, is domestic politics. First of all, the Kremlin is now in a frenzy about 2018. Is Putin going to get reelected with a very large majority? I mean, we may think that's very strange, given his popularity numbers, which our own president and presidential candidates would love to have.
80%, yes.
80%. And so part of this is, right now, is certainly the Ukraine situation has stalemated. Putin made a number of mistakes there. And so now Ukraine has disappeared from the Russian airwaves, and it's all Syria, and it's about Russia reasserting itself as a force for, you know, positive change and stability in the world, and particularly in the Middle East, as opposed to the United States that goes around, you know, supporting color revolutions. And the next point is Russia has a large and restive Muslim and growing Muslim population. It's the only part of the Russian population that's growing. The rest of it's declining. And as Putin himself said in his speech yesterday, there are over 2,000 Russian citizens have gone to fight with ISIS. And, of course, most of them are from the North Caucasus and the Muslim regions of Russia. And, you know, if they come back, they further disrupt the situation in Russia. The North Caucasus is still very restive. And then the third point is Russia has always preferred strong secular leaders in the Middle East, you know, to Islamists. And right from the beginning, they've criticized the United States for supporting the so-called Arab Spring. They never called it the Arab Spring. They want stability there. The Soviet Union had a strong relationship with Assad's father. Syria was a Soviet and then a Russian client state. And even though the Russian presence there declined after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's still, they have a warm water port there. They've just built a new base there. They're a major military supplier to Assad. And they think that the alternative to Assad is, you know, an Islamist regime. The problem here is that they refuse to acknowledge, Putin refuses to acknowledge that one of the reasons that people are joining Islamic State in Syria is precisely because of the way that the Assad regime has brutalized its own population in this civil war with hundreds of thousands of deaths. I agree with David that, in fact, this is not going to resolve the refugee crisis, and that's probably good for Russia. But you can't really resolve the Islamic State question if you keep in power in the long run someone whose actions are providing recruits for Islamic State.
Well, and David, picking up on several things that Angela said, then what can the U.S. do that it hasn't done to bring more stability into Syria? And is the U.S. and even the Obama administration looking for some kind of a exit out of the Middle East because of all the difficult problems there?
Well, I think the Obama administration has been seeking an exit from the Middle East from the beginning, and I think they thought that was their mandate. Get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, don't get drawn back into issues like this. The problem they found was, first of all, if you get out of a country like Iraq too quickly, it can leave a void, it can lead to instability, which has happened. And they have also found that if you avoid playing a constructive role in trying to resolve crises that are fairly small and containable, as Syria may have been at the outset, they get worse, and they don't stay in one place. They spread to Iraq, they spread in via refugees to Europe and so forth. They nonetheless have not changed their view that they don't really want to get involved. And in fact, a White House official was quoted earlier today with regard to Russia getting involved in Syria as, let them have at it. Let them do their worst, you know, because essentially they don't want to be involved. I think the outcome that Secretary Kerry seems to be seeking is a political conversation that brings to the table the Russians, the Syrians, perhaps the interested outsiders like the Turks and the Saudis, with the Iranians playing some arm's length role, that could lead to a transition. I think the United States has already stipulated that Assad could be in place for a period of a number of years of transition and then could go off arguably with immunity. I think what the Russians and the Iranians are most concerned about, with that being now their worst case scenario, that they get to pick who succeeds Assad.
Hmm.
And I think by putting bigger forces in place and with Iran's recent gains, they are now in a position effectively to say, we are going to have a veto in who is selected to succeed Assad if, in fact, he goes.
But are you saying that Kerry is saying something different from what the president said yesterday at the United Nations?
No, I think it's consistent. I think the United States essentially wants a political process. They don't want to get involved militarily for reasons of the overhang and the aftershocks of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Sure.
And I think they're sort of buying into the notion that letting Russia and Iran take the lead on this may create an opening by which you could get a successor or a state that could help fight ISIS. What they don't have an answer to is, what do you do about Iraq? What do you do about the spread of ISIS into places like Afghanistan? What do you do about Yemen? What do you do about Libya? What do you do about the fact that four of the states in the region right now are failed states and likely to be festering for decades to come?
Angela, about a minute before our first break here, and just picking up on what David just said, do you see a path to some semblance of stability in Syria and in this part of the world that would involve the United States?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, the problem now is that, Putin announced this grand coalition to fight ISIS, similar to the anti-Nazi coalition, but we really have no idea how that would work. We have our own coalition, right? The U.S. has, I think, 60 partners who are joined in trying to cope with Islamic State. It's very hard for me to see how these two groups of people can really act in any concerted way, because Putin's ambition is to come out on top here, and as David said, to be the arbiter of who might succeed Assad if he indeed does go, and he may have to go in the future. So I find it very hard to see a path where the U.S. and Russia can really in any meaningful way work together here. And as David said as well, we've had to deal with Russia because of its suddenly, expanded its military activities there, and it didn't leave us any other option. But we're, saying that we're going to have this coalition, that really has to be translated into action, and it's very hard to see how that could happen.
And that's Angela Stent. She's a senior fellow at the Transatlantic Academy, wrote a book called The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Also with us, David Rothkopf, CEO and editor for Foreign Policy. He's the author of a book called National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. We are talking about U.S. relations with Russia. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Yesterday, President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin both spoke at the United Nations. They also met privately yesterday, something that hasn't happened in many months now, talking with our guests David Rothkopf and Angela Stent about U.S.-Russia relations. And I do want to play another clip from the speeches the speech that the president gave yesterday. Here's what Obama said yesterday at the United Nations, talking about Ukraine.
Consider Russia's annexation of Crimea and further aggression in eastern Ukraine. America has few economic interests in Ukraine. We recognize the deep and complex history between Russia and Ukraine. But we cannot stand by when the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a nation is flagrantly violated. If that happens without consequence in Ukraine, it could happen to any nation gathered here today. That's the basis of the sanctions that the United States and our partners impose on Russia. It's not a desire to return to a Cold War.
And again, talking with David Rothkopf and Angela Stent. David, what was the message that President Obama was delivering yesterday about U.S. relations with Russia over this issue of China and Crimea?
Well, I think he was trying to reiterate the rationale behind our opposition to what Russia was doing and to put it in the framework of his broader point, which is that the United States wants to work in a framework of international law and diplomacy before, above, and beyond anything else like the use of force. His speech seemed essentially to be a kind of body language away from the kind of involvement that he has seen Russia do in Ukraine, but also away from the United States getting very involved in places like Syria, pushing it onto the plate of the international community. It didn't, however, really address the fact that the measures taken to date have clearly not altered the behavior, for example, of the Russians. You know, we may have imposed sanctions. We may have upped the sanctions several times. But when you look at Putin, he continues to try to achieve his goals in Ukraine. He's made advances in influence in Belarus. He's made some remarkably aggressive statements with regard to the Baltics and even saying, you know, something to the effect that they would intervene if Sweden entered NATO. He's now got an 80% approval rating, and he has felt with all of this, despite U.S. opposition, that it's the time for Russia to begin to take the lead in a global crisis like Syria. So if the measure of sanctions is that they're actually having the desired effect of slowing down an opponent and getting them to change their course, ours just aren't working.
Well, interestingly, let me quote something else, Angela, that President Obama said yesterday about Russia and Ukraine. He's saying, look at the results. The Ukrainian people are more interested than ever in aligning with Europe instead of Russia. Sanctions have led to capital flight, a contracting economy, a fallen ruble, and the immigration of more educated Russians. He seems to be saying that this yearning for democracy is more powerful than anything the Russians can do.
I think we have to be careful when we talk about the impact of sanctions. The sanctions have had a measurable economic impact on Russia. I mean, the Russian economy wasn't doing well before the sanctions because of the lack of any real reforms there. It was very badly hit, obviously, by the plunge in oil prices and then also by the fall in the value of the ruble. But we'd see, as Obama said, capital flight has increased. More and more young, educated people are leaving. And, you know, you still have the few people who are allowed to criticize Mr. Putin on these issues. For instance, the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, are saying, we, for economic reasons, if we want our country to prosper and be modern, we shouldn't have such an adversarial relationship with the West. So they certainly have had an economic impact across the board. They haven't so far changed Russian behavior. But there has been a ceasefire in place in Ukraine since September the 1st, and it's working reasonably well. There have been fewer incidents of violence, fewer people have been killed. I was in Ukraine a couple of weeks ago, and the Ukrainian government itself acknowledges that there is a ceasefire holding. Now, the reason for that, I think, is and it's clear that Putin can tell the separatists there to stop shooting if he wants to, so we should have no illusions that they're acting independently. And so what Putin is looking to is there's a meeting coming up this week on October the 2nd of the so-called Normandy format. The Germans, the French, the Russians, Ukrainians, there are discussions about the implementation of this very flawed Minsk agreement under which the ceasefire has taken place. But President Hollande has already said that if the ceasefire continues, maybe some of the sanctions might be lifted. So what the Russians are now looking for is to possibly have the Europeans, at least, who already disagree on the sanctions. Germany's tried to hold their feet to the fire to have some of these sanctions lifted. I mean, the U.S. isn't going to lift sanctions. So I would say, you know, they have had some impact here, but not, of course, as quickly as we hoped. But in the longer run, they have. And what Russian actions have done, and again, I think President Obama alluded to that yesterday, they've really helped create a much stronger national identity in Ukraine about who Ukrainians are. But the problem in Ukraine is that you have a twofold threat. You have the external aggression and what's happening in eastern Ukraine, and then you have the continuing inability of the Ukrainian government to deal with the profound problems of corruption and infighting among even the present government, which makes it very difficult for Ukraine to move forward.
Let me get James from, looks like Langhorne, to join our conversation. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, good people. Russia was an important part of the Iranian nuclear deal. And it seems curious that it wasn't until the last Democratic vote supporting the potential veto Obama would have had to have in rejecting the deal, it wasn't until about a day and a half or 2 days after that that it was announced that Russia was putting their bases into Syria. Hmm. Now, I'm just wondering if it was some possibly a tacit agreement that in gaining the deal by doing that, that we were not going to protest too much Russia doing this for their support on a nuclear deal, because our response has been somewhat muted and to a certain degree cooperative, and I've heard nothing at all out of Europe on Russia going in there, particularly with them dealing with all the refugees now. I'm just wondering if your guests thought that there was something possible to that.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, do you think there was some kind of deal with the involvement of Russia helping to broker the deal, the nuclear deal with Iran, and then allowing somehow bases or military people from Russia into Syria?
I have no information that suggests there was a deal, but I don't think the timing was entirely coincidence. I think that they wanted to wait till that deal took place, and at that moment, the Russians and the Iranians felt that they would be in the clear to move forward on this plan and that they would have maximum leverage because the United States obviously wants the plan to work. They're not going to push back too hard on Iran. You know, the response of the U.S. government to Russia moving into this thing has been flat-footed and confused, and it doesn't really look like the U.S. was prepared for the Russians to go ahead and do this.
And there was a question about some information sharing between Russia, Iran, Iraq, and I think there was, I guess, Syria as well.
Syria.
Yeah, and the U.S. was not, I guess, what, informed of that either, David?
No, look, I don't think the U.S. was consulted with. I think Putin, you know, made it very clear in his speech when he said that only Damascus and the Kurds are actually effectively fighting against ISIS. What he was pointedly saying there was he didn't think the United States or our coalition, as we kind of euphemistically refer to it, since most of the countries in it aren't really doing that much, you know, that we are not actually achieving our goals with regard to ISIS. And I think they were just saying, OK, time to move ahead. I was in a breakfast with Rouhani on Friday in which he talked about sharing intelligence with the Russians, talked about their views being completely aligned. 2 days later, the Iraqis announced that they were sharing intelligence. And I think these folks have simply decided there's a void. They're going to fill it. It's in their interests. As Angela was saying, you know, the Russians don't view Syria as a foreign problem. They view this as a local issue because they want to stop the potential flow of Islamist extremists into the gut of Russia. And they see the Damascus regime as a bulwark against that.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor for Foreign Policy, author of a book called National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also with us is Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Transatlantic Academy, actually on leave from Georgetown University. And her book is titled The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And you can join our conversation, as our caller James did, by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Angela, just thinking about what both you and David have been talking about, and it's I'm not saying this is a cold war, but certainly there are some pretty serious disagreements slash conflicts, foreign policy conflicts between the U.S. and Russia. Should we view Russia as an enemy the way we did during the Cold War?
Well, it's as usual, it's complicated. I mean, Russia certainly isn't an ally, and it really hasn't been a partner since we cooperated in the fall of 2001 in the first phase of the war in Afghanistan when it really was a partner. But it's not an enemy as it was during the Cold War. So there was a major ideological clash in the Cold War. I would say there's a growing ideological clash today, and you heard some of that in Putin's speeches, which is that Russia puts itself forward as, you know, being against color revolutions, change of regime, and as the harbinger of conservative values. You know, it courts the right-wing parties in Europe as well as the left-wing ones, that the West is kind of decadent. So there is, and that it favors stability over the U.S. that promotes chaos around the world, because it supports anti-regime movements. So there is sort of an ideological clash. Militarily, of course, we're not in the Cold War. The U.S. is infinitely more powerful militarily than Russia is, even though it can still throw its weight around both in its neighborhood and in regions like the Middle East. But its military capabilities are limited. I guess the difference is that we are economically interconnected in a way that we weren't during the Cold War, and that's particularly true for Europe, not so much for the United States. So so I think we're I don't know whether frenemies is the right word, but it is, you know, as the title of my book says, it's a very limited partnership. It's a compartmented relationship. And we are able to cooperate sometimes on limited issues where our interests coincide. And I would say, in fact, in 2013, cooperating with Russia on disarming Syria of its chemical weapons, you know, worked pretty well. And there again, it's the same pattern that Putin's trying to repeat now, which is that Russia took the lead. It actually took an idea that the United States had previously mentioned, and that meant that the U.S., we were in fact dealing with the Assad regime as we disarmed Syria of its chemical weapons. So on limited issues like this, we can work together, but more broadly, I think our mutual interests are limited. We have a joint responsibility as the two nuclear superpowers, you know, on issues like nonproliferation, and those are special responsibilities, and that's kind of skews the relationship in the direction of this kind of nuclear superpowers. But still, I think we're very wary of Russia, and it's become more of an antagonist in the past few years than it was before.
And to you, David, both the United States and Russia see ISIS or ISIL as a threat. Their goal is to try to get rid of ISIS or destroy it one way or the other. Why doesn't that bring? I mean, obviously, it involves Syria, and that I guess is the complicating factor. But is there that can bring the U.S. and Russia together?
Well, I think that can bring the U.S. and Russia together, and to a degree it already has in Iraq, where the Baghdad government's been working with the Iranians and the Russians. Well, we have also been working with the Baghdad government in trying to fight ISIS and ISIL. The problem is, while ISIS and ISIL or ISIL is a big problem, it's not the only problem in the region, and on some of the other problems there's much less alignment, whether it's other extremist groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, or the representation of the Sunnis in parts of Iraq that they don't feel that they've got it, or in parts of Syria for that matter. We're on different sides on those issues. Outcomes in Yemen, outcomes in Libya, we're on different sides. And so while we might work together to solve one problem, we would quite quickly find ourselves to be on opposite sides of the ensuing problems.
Angela, how much do you think the fact that Edward Snowden is still living in Russia, does that in any way impact the relationship between the U.S. and Russia?
Oh, immensely. I mean, the current downturn in U.S.-Russian relations began when the Russians gave political asylum to Edward Snowden after the White House implored them many times not to do so. That's when President Obama canceled his summit he was supposed to have with President Putin in September of 2013. The fact that he's still there, that he's still providing information, we don't know what he's told the Russians about assets that we have had in Russia. I mean, there are all kinds of big questions about that, and that continues to be, you know, a major issue between the U.S. and Russia, and that really is what poisoned the relationship, I would say, irrevocably for the rest of the Obama administration once they gave him asylum.
We're here talking about the Middle East, and we're talking about Syria, Russia, the United States. Meanwhile, the Taliban is at least retaken an important part of Afghanistan. And it just seems, David, that nothing ever gets resolved in this part of the world.
Well, certainly in Afghanistan, the problems have been there for centuries. The problems, you know, the Sunni-Shia problem is a millennium old. So, you know, I think turmoil goes with the territory. Having said that, it has not in our lifetimes been as bad as it is right now. Really, every country in the Middle East is involved in a war in some way or another, with perhaps one exception. And none of those situations look likely to be resolved anytime soon. Certainly none of them look likely to be resolved in the Obama administration's remaining time in office. Furthermore, there's been a kind of a seismic shift. The Iranians have gained considerably in terms of influence with this deal and with the flow of money into Iran. Their proxies in the world, in Lebanon and Syria and in Yemen and in Baghdad, have also gained an influence, while simultaneously virtually every Sunni state in the region has become weakened one way or another because of the Arab Spring, because of malfeasance or misfeasance by their own leaders and so forth. And so we see a big shift in the status of our former allies and our former enemies and our current allies that makes it very, very unclear what kind of coalitions will be able to come together to effectively address a region that is in the worst state of affairs that it has been in the modern era.
And Angela, we have to say goodbye to you in 30 seconds, but I just want to give you 30 seconds for some final thoughts. Sorry about that.
I think the 30 seconds are Russia is determined to, you know, reestablish itself in the Middle East, in that region, more or less as the Soviet, with the same kind of presence that the Soviet Union has. And it's right now, because of all this chaos, seems to be well on its way to doing so.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Angela Sten, for joining us on Radio Times today. Thank you. She's senior fellow at the Transatlantic Academy, author of The Limits of Partnership. David Rothkopf is going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. Shifting gears, we'll be talking about the U.S. relationship with China, also came up yesterday at the United Nations. And joining us will be Thomas Christensen from Princeton University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We were just talking about the United States' relationship with Russia. We do want to shift gears now. Last week, President Obama hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping at the White House. He spoke yesterday at the UN about growing conflicts in the South China Sea.
In the South China Sea, the United States makes no claim on territory there. We don't adjudicate claims, but like every nation gathered here, we have an interest in upholding the basic principles of freedom of navigation and the free flow of commerce, and in resolving disputes through international law, not the law of force. So we will defend these principles while encouraging China and other claimants to resolve their differences peacefully.
And joining us now is Thomas Christensen, the Boswell Professor of World Politics of Peace and War and Director of the China and the World Program at Princeton University. His new book is called The China Challenge, Shaping the Choices of a Rising Power. And Thomas Christensen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe the relationship between the United States and Russia, and China today?
Well, the relationship in the last few years has gotten more tense. China has been assertive in the South China Sea, not only trying to increase its presence at sea, but actually reclaiming land on previously uninhabited reefs and creating artificial islands. And that's posed a challenge to the other claimants in the region, and there are multiple claimants to those waters and the islands and reefs in those waters. So that's created a lot of tension in the region, and one of those claimants is the Philippines, a U.S. ally. Mm. And the United States has, as the president said, a strong interest in maintaining freedom of navigation, not only for commerce, but also for our military. And our military needs to be able to transverse those waters in order to give our alliances in East Asia credibility.
Do you see this, David, as another potential hotspot?
Yeah, it's certainly a potential hotspot. I think it's a hotspot that may or may not involve the U.S. in the first instance. It certainly has brought China and Japan into more precarious relationship, and the Japanese have been recently taking steps to change their military stance from the purely defensive stance of the post-World War II era to something that would allow them to project force a little bit more. Those are old and open wounds. Clearly, North Korea remains a place where problems could exist, and this South China Sea effort is another. And then more broadly, the Chinese have a strategy for expanding their influence throughout the region, and the United States and our allies do not really. And so as a consequence, they're moving forward, leaning in, and we are leaning back a little bit and forced to watch.
You wrote something recently, Thomas, in Bloomberg, China isn't an enemy of the United States, but coercive diplomacy with China today is arguably more complicated than it was with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, at least after the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. So you're saying that our relationship with China today is even more complicated and fraught than it was a generation or two ago?
Well, my point is that coercive diplomacy with the Soviet Union, while extremely dangerous, and no one should look back on the Cold War with nostalgia, it was a dangerous period. It's good that it was over, and it's my opinion that it's good that the United States prevailed in that. The relationship with China is more complicated from the perspective of coercive diplomacy, in large part because in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea, you have multiple claimants to various islands and reefs and surrounding waters, who, in my opinion, sincerely believe that their claims are legitimate. And the problem there is that during the Cold War, we had fairly clear lines between the camps, with the exception of a place like West Berlin after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So you knew what aggression looked like and what defensive behavior looked like. And all things being equal, that creates some clarity for coercive diplomacy for deterrence. Mm-hmm. In the East China Sea and the South China Sea, since you have overlapping claims by people who sincerely believe their claims are legitimate, you don't have that recognized status quo. It's not really clear what is an aggressive act and what is a defensive act. And we know from human psychology studies, including the Nobel Prize-winning work by Amos Tversky and Kahneman, Daniel Kahneman, that people take bigger risks and run higher costs. They run higher risks and they pay higher costs to defend what they believe is legitimately theirs than they do to gain new things. That's just a widespread phenomenon in human psychology. So if everyone really believes they're defending what's rightfully theirs, it's actually a quite dangerous and complicated situation.
Well, how do you resolve those claims? If you've got several countries claiming an island or a body of water, who resolves that?
Well, it's a very difficult thing. It's our position, the United States position, is different in the East China Sea between Japan and China than it is in the South China Sea. And the U.S. has a global policy, as the president said, of not getting involved in adjudicating maritime disputes. The U.S. is always neutral in those in terms of the sovereignty claims. But in the East China Sea between China and Japan, we have an unusual situation in which the United States says we don't take any position on the sovereignty of the Senkaku Islands or the Diaoyu Islands in Chinese, but we do recognize Japanese administrative control over those islands, which were transferred from the United States to Japan. And therefore, Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Defense Treaty applies to those islands. So there we do have a stand, and there's a more clarity, arguably. In the South China Sea, the U.S. isn't a claimant. You have multiple claimants. There's not a lot of clarity. And the U.S. is trying to base its strategy on an adherence to international law and defense of an American interest in freedom of navigation. And that's more abstract and more likely to lead to misperceptions than when there's clarity on the actual claims themselves.
David, when the Chinese president was in Washington, there was an agreement between the U.S. and China involving controlling pollution, some cap-and-trade agreement, or at least China saying it was going to do some cap-and-trade to control its pollution problem. Also, some agreement on cyber spying. Do you see this as some degree of progress? Can the Chinese be trusted on this?
Well, you talk about two different things. In terms of the climate issues, China has actually begun to be much more constructive in that regard. The administration has had two successful sets of agreements. I think they will lead to some progress in the Paris climate talks at the end of the year.
Right.
And the reason for that is that it's very much in China's self-interest, with a million people a year dying of bad air or air pollution, pollution-related issues, to take steps to fix their climate situation, their environmental situation. On the issue of cyber, I think it's way too early to tell. Even people close to the deal describe it as a framework with very difficult issues remaining to be resolved in terms of whether or not that the Chinese will enforce it, how we would follow up if they didn't. And in fact, I just saw before I joined you a quote from the Director of National Intelligence of the United States saying he was somewhat skeptical that the deal was actually going to work out or produce major benefits for the U.S. The cyber issue is going to be an irritant in a difficult and complicated U.S.-China relationship for many years to come, I think.
I mean, Tom, don't just countries, friends and foe, aren't they always spying on each other?
Yeah, there's a couple of issues on the table that often get conflated in the media coverage of this. Yes, countries spy on each other, that's not a surprise to anyone. And it's not really at the heart of the cyber issue for the United States. The key thing for the United States is there's spying on the one hand, and then there is systematic thievery, the stealing of intellectual property of innovative American companies on the other. And the latter practice is extremely damaging to the economy. It's a not normal international security practice of states to be involved in that. And all public reports suggest that the Chinese state, the Chinese military, the Chinese security bureaus have been involved in the persistent stealing of intellectual property around the world, not just in the United States, for the benefit of the Chinese economy. So that's something that is not tolerable, and that's something that's very dangerous for a highly globalized and interdependent economy around the world, because if the United States and other actors started to take measures against Chinese companies benefiting from that practice, we don't know what the retaliation would be from the Chinese and how much damage it would do to a highly interdependent economy that is reliant on transnational production and cooperation across borders and between companies.
David, let me read you an email which is sort of connecting our discussion about Russia and now our discussion about China. This is an email from Francis. It says, no one on your program has mentioned Chinese military, specifically naval involvement in Syria. Some question about some sources claiming that Chinese aircraft off the Syrian coast. Is this Chinese presence verified? What would be the Chinese goals in getting involved in the Middle East? Can you answer that? Is there some truth to that?
There's been some talk about the Chinese being tangentially involved in Syria or involved in naval exercises in the Mediterranean with the Russians. The Chinese have played a more important role in the diplomatic side of this thing. I think when you look at the Middle East, one of the biggest changes that you see in that region over the course of the past several years is the growing importance of China. China's either the first or second trading partner of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Pakistan. China has sought to expand its ties in the region a great deal. China played a very important role in the Iran nuclear deal. The future exports of oil from the region are going to be picked up heavily by China. And I think one of the things we're seeing in the Middle East more broadly is ever-growing influence by China in the region. And that's by design. The Chinese have this policy they call One Belt, One Road, which leads them to vital resources in places like the Middle East, and where they are seeking to build ties to provide support for themselves in that respect. And that's just going to continue. So they will be a greater factor in each of the Middle East questions that arise over the years ahead.
Tom, we haven't really factored in the Chinese economy. And as we know, it's been going through some tough time, having reverberations around the world, certainly on the American stock market. How should we understand the health, the strength of the Chinese economy?
Well, the Chinese economy has been rocky by Chinese standards. They still have relatively high rates of growth by global standards, but not as high as people had hoped and expected, and that's usually what rocks markets. The biggest problem with the Chinese economy is that they have to go through a significant restructuring to maintain growth into the future, and the Chinese leadership knows that, and it has laid out a blueprint for a fairly significant reform program, but it's been unable or unwilling to implement that during what have been economic rocky times. So moving forward, we're going to have to see whether that reform program, which would give more power to banks to make market-based decisions, which would eventually create a healthy stock market instead of an unhealthy one, and to give more power to consumers and base economic growth more on consumption and less on exports and on heavy domestic investment, whether all those things will work. And this hasn't been tried before. A very large economy that's growing quickly, that's going to reform in the process as it continues to grow. And I think it makes the leadership very nervous because they know that the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party as a regime is largely based on continued economic growth and meeting the expectations of the Chinese population for continued economic growth.
David, anything you want to weigh in on that? It sounds like a pretty big test for China and its leadership.
China does face a big test. Having said that, you know, I've been in Washington for 25 years, and every year or two, somebody comes out and says, this is the moment China stumbles. And China never stumbles. You know, they do manage their way through these things extremely well. They do tend to find soft landings instead of hard landings. They are growing at a fairly substantial rate. The world economy does depend on them a lot. And I think it's kind of a sucker's bet to bet against China in the medium to long term.
To you, Tom, and we haven't really talked about North Korea, but is that a country and a regime that both the United States and China have some agreement on about what to do about?
No, we don't really have an agreement on what to do about North Korea. We do, I believe, have an agreement on what we want from North Korea to some degree, and that is both China and the United States would like North Korea to abolish its nuclear weapons program. But how do you get there? There are often disagreements on what are the appropriate measures in dealing with North Korea. And I worked in the six-party talks when I was in the government, and I cover this in the book. But it's often the case that China is reluctant to put significant pressure on North Korea, which China can do, given North Korea's economic dependence on China, because China values the stability of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula even more than it values denuclearization. So it's been a source of frustration for the United States because the United States already has sweeping sanctions on North Korea, as much pressure as we can put without actually using military force. And China is the real holder of leverage at this point, but China seems unwilling to put persistent, serious pressure on Pyongyang to get rid of its nuclear program, and that's a source of frustration for U.S. diplomats.
David, we're almost out of time here. From your perspective, how would you describe then the Obama doctrine?
I think the Obama doctrine is essentially to try to rely on the international system, try to rely on international law, try to rely on diplomacy as much as possible to resolve issues, and to avoid conflicts where you don't see that there is a clear outcome. And when you do get involved, to limit the involvement to a shorter period of time and as narrow means of intervention as possible. And, you know, that avoids the Iraq war. The problem is it also opens the door to the Syria war. And that's the balancing act that I think is going to face the next president of the United States, is they have to find a better balance than either Bush or Obama.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. David Rothkopf, thanks so much for joining us in this hour of Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's CEO and editor for Foreign Policy, author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Tom Christensen, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's the Boswell Professor of World Politics of Peace and War, director of the China and the World Program at Princeton University. And his new book is called The China Challenge, Shaping the Choices of a Rising Power. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.